Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags and I've got 30 minutes packed with the latest South African and global news. We are live right now, then up as a podcast. Stay tuned for interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts delivering all the essential updates that you need, fast and focused. It's Friday, the 13th of September. On the program today, we'll reflect in depth on the life of former Finance Minister Pravin Gordhan, who has died. We'll look at his political contribution as well as his life as an activist. Also, how the new two-pot retirement system is exposing employers and why the trade environment in South Africa is improving, according to the South African Chamber of Commerce and Industry. Now, you'll be well aware that Pravin Gordhan, the founding commissioner of the South African Revenue Service and also twice finance minister, and also the person who led the fight against the Zuma and Gupta-led state capture era, has died of cancer. He was 75 years old. I'm going to start the program with Ishmael Mamoniat, who is an advisor to the National Treasury. And Ishmael, firstly then, what key role, in your opinion, did Pravin Gordhan play, particularly in shaping post-apartheid economic policy in South Africa?
I think what Pravin has brought is the whole principle of, and he was a leading example of how to serve the people of South Africa. In everything he did, and I've known him from the late 70s, whether as we were activists, whether it was in the establishment of the UDF, whether it was post-democracy when he was the head of SARS, whether he was my boss as the Minister of Finance, and subsequently, that it was all about serving the people. And he spent all his time doing so. In fact, to the point where I couldn't understand, I was surprised that he even had time to watch sports, which he got to love because of his wife, Wani, and her family. But yes, bringing in ethics and serving people with integrity and honesty is what he brought. And especially at a time when corruption has become so entrenched, Pravin doesn't leave this world with great wealth. His only earnings were his ministerial or SARS income. And I think the lesson like he had when he led SARS, he talked about serving the higher purpose. And I think that's why he was able to inspire SARS to become a world-class organization. That's why when he was Minister of Finance, he began to see, when we began to identify bits and pieces of corruption that we heard about, that we, to use his words, we had to connect the dots because we couldn't understand what was happening. And it's hard to understand when president of our country is leading the charge to loot our entities, to destroy our institutions, as we saw with state capture. And what we had to do at the Treasury and through his efforts was then to connect the dots and to try and fight your own president, which is enormously courageous of him to do and difficult to do. And that's why he was not reappointed minister and fired again, as was Mr. Nene, because, you know, together with Mr. Nene, they kind of began, as they saw the corruption, to try and block it, to try and take action against it. And yes, for his sins, he suffered because you had a compromise, Hawks or DPCI, you had a compromise NPA, and they charged him. But despite that, he was also the most innovative of people. And the innovative approach led us to, for example, expose the 72 transactions that the Guptas, that through an FIC certificate. by taking out a court action against Ogbe Investments at a time when Cabinet was supporting the Guptas when their bank accounts were being closed. So Praveen was enormously courageous, and you know, I think he was a giant in our struggle for democracy and post-democracy in building a new society.
Perhaps you could further reflect on impact in that respect then. In what way did his resistance to the Zuma-Gupta state capture project shape South Africa's political landscape, not in the here and now, but perhaps going forward?
Look, I think that going forward, nothing's for certain yet. And at the moment, we have a very toxic political environment where you also see, you know, those who are at the center of the corruption even becoming MPs. So I think what we need to learn is because of the efforts of people like Praveen, you had the Zondo Commission. It's outlined in detail, you know, the corruption that took place, and have, I believe, solid recommendations about how to prevent such corruption. I think that those are the types of ideas, and I think as he was head of public enterprises, I think to look at the governance improvements that he considered, which I think still need to be debated. I don't agree with all of those, for example, but I think he put up those ideas. He had good intentions, and he couldn't finish the job now with his untimely death. But what he already did was to begin to expose those corruptive practices. But in terms of legacy and going into the future, I think the lessons are there, and it's going to be up to many of us who knew him and understand the reforms that he wanted and which have not been put in place to do so. So to give you an example, you had the Nugent Commission. It talked about how the government should make appointments, how boards should be appointed. I think those are the types of reforms that will act as a check and balance against, for example, a corrupt minister who wants to appoint the wrong people. But, you know, those are still intermediary steps to get good governance, but with the end of ensuring that those institutions deliver to the people of South Africa, generate revenue, don't become reliant on the fiscus, but actually get economic growth up. And he always stood for inclusive economic growth. I think, you know, Praveen started off as a housing activist. And I think it pained him to see that we couldn't crack these problems. And as the state has struggled, because of the looting, we lose our investment grade, we get grey-listed, that the government really is now at a point where it doesn't have the resources that perhaps we had right in the first 15 years of our democracy.
And with that, I am going to thank you, Ishmael Mamoniat. I do appreciate your time today. Thank you. I want to reflect now on Pravin Gordhan's political contribution with T.K. Puwe from the Wits School of Governance. And T.K., firstly, no doubt, as we've just heard, a man of integrity. But how is he going to be judged as a cabinet minister? His performance, it's fair to say, I think, that it was patchy at times.
Yes, I think it's going to wax and wane depending on who speaks about him. I think if you speak about the start of his career, specifically at Treasury and his role he played in setting up SARS, there's lots of stories to hear about how he really was quite influential in pushing for SARS to be quite an efficient institution. You know, that will not be ignored, and I think it's something that a lot of people probably spend a lot of time on. But I think there's always that quote that says, you know, if you live long enough and you might end up being the very person you thought you were fighting, that I think in the latter years of his political career, especially as a minister of public enterprise, a lot of holes are going to be poked at to say, listen, yes, you came with this great legacy of being an institutional reformer and also somebody who really gets things done. However, a lot of state-owned entities, you know, were allowed to collapse under your watch. I'd always put a caveat to say that, look, they were collapsing, and I think he should have and probably should have done more. But I think it really is going to be who speaks about him. But I think it's going to be characterized by two epochs. There's his early years at Treasury and the great work he did there, and his stint as finance minister and partially a COCTA. Then I think the latter years where a lot of things just really fell apart, and maybe probably it should have been a prelude for him to maybe go do other things, because I think he had enough talent to go maybe do other things and contribute to South Africa.
I want to return to state-owned enterprises in just a moment, but when he left as finance minister in 2017, let's make no mistake, South Africa financially was in trouble. A debt was over 2 trillion rand, or 56% of GDP.
And yes, and I think that's where it really does get to it. Because look, in as much as I think the exit, and sometimes we also, you're quite right, you have to be honest about the exit that he was recalled from it. But South Africa was not doing great at that moment in time. And that's why some of the detractors, I think correctly also say, but listen, while you're noted for the whole state capture thing, you were the head of Treasury, and Treasury is supposed to be at the apex of making sure that we actually know what's happening with the country's finances. And he seems to have not been able to probably do, I think, what he wanted to do there, which is to really say, listen, get the economy to grow. And at the same time, I think, have a better handle of why the country's finances were going in the wrong direction. So you're quite correct in saying his stint in Treasury wasn't all too successful. But I think there's two stints. There's one where he started off, and then I think there is the 2017 one where things didn't really go in accordance.
As far as parastatals like Eskom and SAA were concerned, and the inability to revive them, were they just too big to try and turn around? Because let's be quite honest, both of those under different cabinet ministers find themselves in pretty much the same place.
So yes and no. I believe he had the personality to do it, and I think the political clout. But it would seem as though when you get to those positions, you kind of need the I think a specific sort of support from the rest of the political apparatus, specifically the president. And I think that's where he fell short, which is to say, having dealt with him, especially speaking about SOEs, he knew that the rot was there and he wanted to do something about it. But I think maybe procedure, and by procedure here, I mean that instead of maybe starting with the institution, the right place would have been to start with his party, because I think we cannot get away from the fact that a lot of these state-owned entities have been compromised by ANC-linked politicians and the ANC apparatus. And a lot of the people there, even people from these state-owned entities, will tell you that, listen, it's one thing to blame us and they could take the blame, but to say the right place where the minister should have started is his own political party, because they're the ones who really kept dragging their feet, as they currently are at the moment, with reforming state-owned entities. And I always say the state-owned entities, historically, the world over, do get reformed. It's not as though it's a new thing. But the key issue is the political party in charge willing to really take the risk and say, listen, even if our members go to jail, so be it. And I think maybe the minister there didn't have enough political clout within the ANC. And this is seen in the fact that in his latter years, he really became less influential within the ANC. And it was maybe became harder for him to use government to really get to the root cause of many of the problems of state-owned entities.
Notwithstanding that, of course, a famous line that will always be attributed to him is connect the dots. And he did play an important role in the Zuma Gupta era and calling out state capture.
He did, look, I think he was always one for quotes. He was very good at putting, I think, a lot of quotes in there that assisted. But I think, as you know, history is a very terrible thing, in that as time goes on, we sort of yearn to say, listen, could more have been done? I think we should take that he was one of the few ministers who said, listen, this thing is happening. He suffered the consequences for it. But I think until South Africans, and this is always the thing about South Africans, until South Africans see people in orange overalls, it will always be a question of could more have been done. He did his part, but I think until we see people in orange overalls, it will always be a question that says, he did well, but where was the follow-up? And unfortunately, that was not within his domain to do.
TK Poor, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The new South African Chamber of Commerce and Industry Trade Conditions Survey says the political broadening of governance has led to encouragement of expectations in the trade environment. Richard Downing, economist, is with us now. Richard, welcome to you. Thank you. So we're talking about a surge in trade expectations. What specific factors are driving this, apart from the new governance under the Government of National Unity?
Well, I think expectations, you know, all over the place to some extent. You know, there's expectations that things will get better. And it's got a lot to do with, forming a government that's quite aware, you know, of the economic consequences of where we are at the moment. And I think that actually spurred your trade expectations for the next 6 months. That's what we're looking at, and that's what we're asking the cross respondents. So that is quite a positive movement. And we last saw the figure stood at 66 in the index. It's quite above 50, which is the benchmark figure. And that was last seen in 2006, you know, when the economy was growing quite at a good rate and so on. So there's quite a lot of expectations. But I think, you know, if you look at if we ask the respondents, okay, how things are doing now at the moment, and then you get a figure that is still in negative territory, that is the index is below 50, indicating to us that perhaps expectations were a bit far-fetched at this stage, and it'll take time, you know, for the economy to really get through all the high wire and being seen in positive trade conditions.
So what is it going to take then, in your opinion, and you rightly say that we need to temper those expectations, but what will it take to make conditions a little bit more sustainable?
Well, I think at the moment, you know, especially if you take retail trade, for instance, I mean, one of the big issues there is actually your consumer and his disposable income after interest and interest payments and debt payments. And that is a big issue to some extent. I think so. Even if we can get to a situation where we can lower interest rates or ease a bit on monetary policy, then that could benefit your retail trade as such, and especially also your motor trade. And then, of course, there's issues like international trade, which actually carried us through a lot of the difficult times, but you need to stay competitive. And for instance, now our visit to China, it was highlighted again, you know, there's quite a big deficit with those type of countries, a trade deficit. So, you know, and that is about international competitiveness. And I think so there's a lot of issues that must be addressed before you will really see it on all fronts, the trade movement actually being more positive. And we know about what's going on in the construction industry in terms of all kinds of sort of things that outside the economic sphere. And that is unfortunate, you know, also having an effect on the trade in property and that type of thing. So there's a lot of things that must be attended to. And I think the expectations is based on the fact that the hope is there that we're with more people giving inputs into governing sort of some of the state-owned enterprises and even your government and local authorities especially. I think that is a main sort of question that must be answered and must be looked at.
And notwithstanding the green shoots that you're talking about, none of this, of course, has helped around the ongoing logistical uncertainty that still exists around Transnet.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, if you look at a macroeconomic picture, you know, our first half year of 24, you saw actually fixed investment declining by about 6%, you know, on the first half of 23. So that is a big sort of concern. If you don't get investor confidence going again, you won't have the economic results in the end. And I think that is a main sort of issue that must be addressed. And as you've mentioned, you know, Transnet, your Eskom stories, your logistic issues, those are very important because that is the linkages in the economy that must be kept alive and be oiled well. And that is the problem we're facing at the moment. So we hope that, you know, with more insights in government and inputs from all kinds of all the role players in the economy, that we will see a sort of improvement there, because investor confidence is actually a major issue. And we must remember, investors are looking 5 to 10 years ahead. And if you don't get your policy situation right, that won't help a lot, you know, if you can have government all over the place but still moving in the wrong direction in terms of policy.
All right, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed, economist Richard Downing.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, in a similar vein, manufacturing output has started the third quarter of 2024 on a solid note. The number, of course, is an important barometer of the South African economy. More now from Thanda Setole, FNB senior economist. And what then, in your opinion, has contributed to the rebound?
Thanks, Jeremy. So, yes, we did see manufacturing output starting the third quarter on a good note, up 1.7% year-on-year, as we have said, coming from a 5.5% contraction in the month of June. And the outcome actually was positive and above consensus expectation of around 0.7%. But if you look at what really contributed to this, there were about five sectors or divisions that posted positive growth, while the remaining five actually contracted. But within those divisions that posted positive growth, we focus mainly on the major ones, which is your food, beverages, basic iron and steel, wood and wood product, as well as petroleum related products. And those four divisions really contributed positively to overall increase in manufacturing production. And the biggest increase really came from food and beverages, which was 9.5% year on year. And largely within food and beverages division, it was your dairy products, other food products, as well as beverages.
And what do you think is driving the positivity in that sector?
I think inflation has come down and has made a lot of progress to come down. And I think nominal wage growth also is supporting consumers' income. And I think that demand is contributing to the increased production of those. Obviously, these divisions are quite volatile. So in one month, you'll see this growth. The other month, you'll see a decline. But I think there is some improvement from a demand side slightly as a result of inflation having come down significantly.
And which are the sectors that still pose a risk?
I think just overall, manufacturing production still faces significant risk because even though we have had no load shedding for over 150 consecutive days, I think demand still remains a problem. So from that perspective, we still have most of the sectors facing some risks. If you look at private sector fixed investment overall, it's been contracting for quite some time on a quarter-on-quarter basis, and that means that demand for manufactured products is still going to be a problem. But specifically, if you look at the automotive sector, that's the sector that is actually facing a major risk, simply because if you look at new vehicle sales, they are down on a year-to-date basis by over 3% as a result of higher interest rates. So production in that space remains significantly constrained. In fact, on a year-to-date basis, motor vehicle production are down by about 10.4%. That's quite deep, and I think that that still faces a downside risk over the near term.
And adding to the problem in that particular sector is that there hasn't been a huge increase in exports.
Definitely, yes. If you look at our exports for vehicles as well, they have declined quite significantly. And it speaks to both weak external demand as well as domestic demand, basically.
It's interesting to see that there's been an increase in iron and steel output in July, 5.2%, if I'm reading the numbers correctly. What would be driving that?
It's still not clear what is actually driving that. As I have said, some of these divisions, they are quite volatile. So for us, what we'd like to see is a sustained increase. For us, a sustained increase will mean that probably there's increased demand from a construction perspective. But as far as we know for now, construction is still significantly constrained. I think the GDP data did indicate that came out last week, that the construction sector is still under a lot of pressure as a result of weak residential as well as non-residential buildings, but also construction works. So for us, we'll definitely need a sustained period of increase in basic iron and steel for us to start to believe that there is a trend building here. Mm. But over and above that, we think that this is just the usual month-on-month volatility that we normally see in the data.
Nonetheless, the manufacturing side is to be welcomed. There's also been a good improvement in the business activity index, 36.3 to 50.8%. That is indicating surely a sign of improved confidence in the economy. So many people are talking about the green shoots. It's clear from those numbers, surely, that those green shoots now are starting to flourish.
Sure. So what is interesting is that the index, after increasing, it then fell back again in the month of August. So as we speak now, it is currently below the 50 neutral mark. So it's that volatility that I'm talking about. But I think from a long-term perspective, there is really some optimism that the economy has actually turned the corner. As far as our forecasts are concerned for GDP growth, we think that growth will be around 1% this year, lifting to around 1.8 and 1.9 in the two outer years, that is 2025 and 2026. So I think we have turned the corner. There is this GNU-linked optimism that is going to drive economic growth, but also the easing energy constraints are going to be critical in terms of driving long-term economic growth. And we think that the continued disinflationary process that has taken place, as the anticipated interest rate cuts, are all going to contribute to some improvement in demand, leading to higher levels of GDP growth over the medium term.
Tando Sithole, thank you very much indeed. Senior economist at FNB.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And finally on the program today, the pension fund adjudicator sounding the alarm on companies that do not pay over employee funds to administrators as the two-pot claims mount in the first 2 weeks of the new retirement system. I want to get some clarity now from her, and welcome to Mubango Lukaimane. And first of all, what specific role then does the administrator play, and perhaps more importantly, how critical is it to ensuring the integrity of employees' retirement savings?
My concern is really that we are already receiving inquiries. Whereas we had projected that our office will start dealing with two-pot related complaints in about 2-3 months' time, the resources that we have put in place dedicated to receive inquiries on this are already receiving inquiries. And that is because members who want to claim, some of them are going to their funds, and when they get there, they find that there's nothing in the vested pot, there's nothing in the savings pot, and there's definitely nothing in the retirement pot. Whereas they know that deductions have been made from their salaries all along, and so they were expecting that there would be something in all three pots. So that is really where our involvement comes in.
And if I'm hearing you correctly, this is criminal of nature. How widespread is this, do you think?
Well, it is quite widespread. I can only speak from the list that the FSCA released early in the year, and also from the complaints that we finalized in our office. 82% of the complaints that we finalize in our office have in one way or another to do with employers not having paid contributions. It might be that they paid but did not pay all the contributions, or they didn't pay at all, or they stopped paying somewhere in the middle.
What are the most common excuses that are being encountered in this respect?
Well, the biggest excuse is really around financial difficulty. However, we cannot even put this down to COVID, because when COVID hit, there were some employers that jumped on the bandwagon of COVID, and it might have looked as if COVID was the issue. But this problem has been coming along well before COVID. In some instances, it is just employers not wanting to comply. In other instances, you find that employers also get frustrated with the way that a fund is managed, and they stop contributing until the fund administrator can sort out whatever administrative issues might be going on. But then that is not in line with the law. You can never stop, but there are avenues where they can report to the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, because the administrator is licensed by them anyway.
And it took the implementation of the two-pot system to bring this to light.
Yes, because before, what used to happen is that a person would only discover this at claim stage. Now, claim stage is drips and drabs. But now, because people are accessing their money whilst in employment, it's suddenly a bigger number of people that are realizing that their contributions were not paid on time. And it's actually quite opportune in a way, because one of the things that people don't know is that retirement fund contributions actually prescribe. If you don't claim in time, if you don't get to reasonably know and keep up to date in time that you are owed, even by the time you approach our office, we can only recover what we can, subject to prescription.
And often that process is very difficult.
Yes, often that process. No, our process is quite easy. If you lodge a complaint with us, we will be able to finalize your complaint in a period of not even more than 4 or 5 months. We would have an outcome that is akin to a high court order for you. But the issue is, if you don't activate your claim on time, we might say to you, but given the surrounding circumstances, you should have known that the employer was not contributing. Therefore, even though you worked for 7 years, even though you can prove deductions for 7 years, we can only give you 3 years worth of your contribution.
Which could lead to a huge amount of heartache, particularly if you are depending on that money, as most of us are. How difficult would it be, Mubango, to enforce that order once it's given?
Well, it's not difficult at all because our orders are the same as High Court orders. So the sheriff is obliged to assist the person to implement that order. Once we realized the extent of the problem, we then started giving what we call orders sounding in money. So the exact amount that you are owed will be sitting on the order so that it's easy for you to enforce. We also work with law companies that do pro bono work and also the legal aid clinic to help the complainants enforce where they are unable to do so by themselves.
You said to me the problem is fairly widespread. Have you specifically noticed, though, any particular industries or sectors that are more prone to not paying over pension funds to administrators?
Well, your biggest sector at the moment is your private security sector. Then you will find that in the retail sector, there's quite a bit. Our office then receives quite a significant number of complaints from the transport sector and also the metal and engineering sectors. Also, if I can add, those being your sort of private sector organizations, in the public sector, we also find that, unfortunately, municipalities and some SOEs also fall foul of the law.
Beyond the court order, are there other penalties or legal consequences that companies can or must face when they fail to pay over, as required by law?
Yes, there is. And it's really a shame because it is the board of the fund that must chase after these outstanding contributions, that must actually follow the steps in the Act. After 90 days, they can report this matter as a criminal matter to the South African Police Service. And then because the Pension Funds Act makes it a crime not to pay contributions, and you can be imprisoned for up to 10 years. For failure to do so. It is just that funds don't activate these processes. Either they don't do anything at all, or most of your big umbrella funds will just liquidate the employer's participation in the fund when they see that they have not paid for 3 months or so, for 90 days, and then the members are just left to sort themselves out.
And is there any way that employees can protect themselves from being shortchanged, and particularly in the sectors that you've mentioned, like security or retail, when non-compliance appears to be rampant?
The first thing that members must do is, when you know that you are registered with a pension fund or you are supposed to, ask for the details of that fund from your employer. Get your membership certificate while it's still in the beginning. If a year at the end of the financial year of that fund, ask for your benefit statement. If you don't get a benefit statement, that's usually your first concern, to say, why haven't I received a benefit statement? And then when you receive your benefit statement, then you are able to see whether the employer has paid everything over. If you don't receive your benefit statement, then you are able to lodge a complaint on that fact on its own to say, I need my benefit statement, I need proof that I've been registered with a fund.
Thank you so much for outlining and bringing to light what is a very serious problem. And as you rightly say, possibly the two-pot implementation has helped raise this to the surface. The pension fund adjudicator, Mobango Lokaimani, I do appreciate your time today. Thank you. And that is our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening. Goodbye and have a good weekend.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.